Hello, viewers and listeners. This is your co-host, Stu, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Hi, Patty. How are you tonight?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Pretty good. You have a good weekend?
I had a busy weekend. Yeah, I was down in Gettysburg for part of it.
Oh, that sounds fun.
I didn't go ghost hunting or anything like that, but I just got to hang out with my paranormal friends.
Always a good time.
It was absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, As a homeowner, I did yard work, and then now today I knew it was going to start raining around 2 o'clock, so I wanted to make sure that it's just Mrs. Stu and me in the house. So I got a pretty good size turkey breast, and I put it on the smoker, and that took like 4.5 hours, and we had a wonderful meal of nice, juicy smoked turkey, hickory smoked turkey.
My middle boy is interested in getting a smoker. I told him he should talk to you and kind of get the lay of the land. You would know more about it than I would by far.
Oh, I've been smoking stuff for a long time, even back whenever I only had a Weber kettle grill. I'll talk smoking meat with anybody.
Well,
and vegetables, you know, we don't want to leave anybody out. We can smoke the vegetables too if you like, and cheese. Yeah.
Smoked cheese is amazing.
Yeah, so before we dig into it, if you are watching on YouTube and you're not a subscriber, we would very much appreciate it if you were to click the subscribe button down below. Click the bell so that you get notified when we release new content, which is typically Friday evenings around 7 p.m. Eastern. If you enjoy this content, click the thumbs up or the like button. That will allow YouTube to adjust their algorithm, and you'll see maybe more of our content as well as other related things. We have several Facebook groups. We'd be happy to have you join us there if you haven't already. It's a lively conversation we have sometimes. We have a lot of people posting. And we also have the email address, paranormalist@theparanormalistpodcast.com, where we will also take your feedback, your ideas, your comments, whatever. And you can do it in a more private way if you don't want to do it on a Facebook group or on a comment onto the YouTube or Rumble, which we are on there too now. So with that, I think I've said my little spiel at the beginning that I normally do, and this is the point where I ask you, what are you going to bless us with this evening?
Well, urban legends, but these are urban legends that have a twist, because most of them are true.
Oh, I'd expect nothing less from you, I guess.
Well, you know, the concept of an urban legend is that it's these usually unsubstantiated or unsubstantiatable stories that, you know, get bigger and grow as people tell them and they pass down through society. And they're part of the folklore, if you will, of the people of a culture. Psychologists, they believe that this is because people have this morbid fascination and they enjoy talking about this stuff and the gossiping, the sharing others' misfortunes and things like that. And I don't honestly know if that's all of it at all. But I chose some stories and I did some research on them. And I left out some because I've mentioned them before, but they're very good stories as well. But I thought we would get started here and we would talk a little bit about some of the really interesting stories that I came across. The first one is a story that takes place in New York State, up around New York City general area, and it is called Cropsey. So there was a legend on, I believe it's Staten Island in New York City. And this is going back to the 60s, 70s. And the legend, which was very popular with the kids of that time period, was that there was this man with a hook for a hand. And he was, typical story, he was, had escaped an insane asylum. And he would go out at night and he would steal children and drag them off into the wilderness with this hooked hand and murder them. And it was the quintessential be in before the street lights come on because you think Cropsey will come and get you kind of story.
Okay.
And I'm sure that mothers made great hay with it at different points because it was a really popular story at the time. And it remained popular for quite a long time. As a story, as a fictional story, it's interesting. But here's what makes this story different. It's not just fiction. So in the 1970s, as I said, they were all these stories about kids disappearing. In the mid-70s, suddenly there were real people disappearing. It started with a five-year-old little girl who was killed and her body was found. And over the course of a couple years, there were several other people who were killed. Now, most of them were young and most of them were female, but one of the later ones was actually a 21-year-old man. And so there didn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to what was going on. And people started talking about, there was this old mental institution on the island and it was called Willowbrook. It was abandoned and had just been sitting there for quite a while. So people were fascinated with it, you know, and then people started saying, well, that's where Cropsey lives. Originally, it was a different place. It was a tuberculosis sanatorium on the other side, but eventually the Cropsey character gets moved to Willowbrook. And the scary part is that's where the bodies start being found.
Oh, that makes me think copycat, you know, or somebody taking advantage of that. But
yeah, and that might have been, but I don't honestly know. What they do find out eventually is they do catch the guy. His name was Andre Rand. That was not his original name, but he changed it. He shortened it and Americanized it to Andre Rand. And he had been a janitor at Willowbrook. And when Willowbrook became defunct, mm-hmm. instead of going for another job, he had been apparently living in the abandoned buildings and had occupied himself with stalking people and young people, particularly little girls, and murdering them. And it was just horrendous to see that this story came to life. He was put on trial in, I believe, 1987, and was sentenced to life without any possibility of parole. He always insisted he was innocent. I think he was mentally ill, and possibly had some mental slowness, if you will. So he insisted he would write these crazy letters to the local newspapers. I read one of the letters. It was near Mother's Day, and he sent this letter for them to publish for the mothers of the children that had died. And it was like, you know, I can't believe that you continue with this kind of vendetta against an innocent man, blah, 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 but I'm a kind man. So if I become a millionaire, I'll send you each a bunch of seeds so you can plant roses. And every time they bloom, you'll remember that I will forgive you for all that you have done to me. Like he just, you know, he was just very ill.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that makes this story so creepy is that he really became that character. And they don't know if it's just a coincidence. Like, he didn't seem to know much about Cropsey, other than, you know, the name. And but he literally took on the persona.
Wow. Yeah, I don't think that's the mark of a mentally stable person. But I think you can say better than I could. Yeah.
Well, you know, but honestly, I've seen and I've read a lot of stuff about him over the years. There's a wonderful documentary that was put out several years ago called Cropsey. And it's actually done by a young man who had grown up there, had heard the Cropsey stories and had been alive during the period when all the children were, he was a child there during that period, and about how it impacted him, you know, with the fear and what have you, as he was trying to grow up and his family, everybody became very suspicious and the children couldn't go out and play anymore and those sort of things. So he, as an adult, and he became a videographer, and he did this amazing documentary about not just the legend, but about how Andre Rand became Cropsey. I've seen it probably three times, and I highly recommend it. He won a lot of awards for it and what have you, but and he certainly should have. It was a really well done, very intimate and informative piece all at the same time.
I have to look that up. Yeah. Do you know who the actor was that played him?
I don't know anything about the actor. I just know that that if you put in the documentary Cropsey, it'll come up. I think his name is Justin something. But I can get it for you if you want me to.
Okay. Well, I'm sure I can look it up. I mean, that is my sphere of of what I do.
So, but it's a fascinating story.
It does
I highly recommend it to people. So the next urban legend is the body under the bed. So here's the story is the way it's told. Some vacationing couple, often newlyweds or somebody visiting, you know, Disneyland or something, they rent this hotel room and they come in and they're happy and they're having a great time. And they, you know, settle into their room for the night after their first evening out. And they notice a funny smell in the room. And it gets worse as the night goes on, you know, as though they're, you know, as they're laying in bed and it just seems like it's strong. So they get up and they're like, something under the, maybe a mouse or something die underneath the bed. And mm-hmm. they start poking around under the bed. And that's when they discover the body under the bed or in the mattress or, you know, you can take your pick. So that's the story. And I thought, well, now that just sounds crazy.
Yeah, especially because every hotel that I've been in the modern era, at least that I can recall, you can't get under the bed. It's boxed in.
Yeah. So
maybe that's why.
Maybe that is why. Because here's the story. Yeah. So it has been found multiple times. There's at least a dozen newspaper stories of different hotels where under the bed was the disposal site for a body. In 1999 in Atlantic City, there was a mattress that somebody had split open and shoved the corpse up inside the mattress and then put it back down. And the people that came in and rented the room ended up finding it. In Colorado, in Florida, in Virginia, there was a Budget Inn in Memphis, Tennessee in 2010 that had the body of a woman named Sunny Millbrook in it. She was missing, and the perpetrator had actually taken fabric softener sheets and had stuffed them up in the ceiling tiles to make the area above the bed smell that strong smell of the sheets. And he had done a good job because three other people had rented that room previous to this couple that rents it the night the body's found, and They didn't smell anything. The boyfriend, his name was Lakeith Moody, would eventually be arrested for the murder of this woman. And it was just, there's just so many of these stories. I had no clue. I found one that said in July of 1996, they found that there was a travel lodge in Pasadena, California, and a body was found there. And in that instance, they had the board bed, the boxed in bed. Mm-hmm. He pried a board off and shoved the corpse in.
Oh.
So folklore and urban legend, all you want, creepy as it is, apparently it is not unheard of.
Well, I mean, all it would take is, you know, one or more sick individuals to hear those stories and say, hey, that's a great idea.
Sure. Or I can honestly say I could see you know, somebody getting in a fight with their girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever, and they don't know how to get rid of the body. Well, you know, you hide it there. You don't take it with you. And that's exactly what they did in these instances.
Or whatever. Yeah, I'm trying to wrap my head around that because, you know, a human body takes up a specific amount of space, whether it's alive or dead. And I don't think mattresses have a lot of room inside them. I mean, you know, springs or memory foam or whatever. I don't think there's a lot of spare room inside there.
No, but that's exactly what, you know, that's what happened. it is crazy as it sounds, this is an urban legend that is housed in truth. I found a whole list. We're not only going to do a few of them tonight, but I found an entire list filled with them. It's insane how many of these urban legends that are fiction, quote unquote, have a real life counterpart. And that brings me to one that sounds like it absolutely cannot be true, and it's the bunny legend of the bunny man. So,
okay.
So I'm a goat man. I'm a goat man girl myself. I really love goat man stories. Like, they're my favorites. And they really are. I have probably got a dozen and a half goat man stories from all over the country. But in this instance, there is a set of stories about a bunny man in Virginia. There's a place called the Bunny Man Bridge, and it is a real place. It does exist. So in the 1970s in Virginia, the story of the Bunny Man began to take over. And the story was that this was an escaped mental patient. When I read the story in more depth, it sounded like there had been apparently a facility and they had closed their doors. And that's the time frame when a lot of the mental health facilities began to start closing down. And so this was a very viable possibility at that time frame. And that they were putting them on buses and busing them to other facilities. And that on this particular bus, there had been an accident and everybody had been rounded up except for one person who supposedly never was. And that's how the stories originally started. And within a day or so, people began finding the half-eaten raw bunny parts in the woods, and the police were looking for this dude, and so they were finding this stuff. And then, of course, it became the story gets to get better and bigger and what have you. And so then it was that they were finding the bodies hanging from this bridge called the Bunny Man Bridge. And all of this, and then local teens kind of took it over, and Bunny Man Bridge became a local gathering place, and they were going to, you know, find the Bunny Man and get him. And the story escalates to the point where supposedly one night a group of kids came to Bunny Man Bridge, and instead of the corpses of dead bunnies hanging there, there was a teenage boy hanging there. And that's when the legend kind of stops at that point. But here we go. There was, in October of 1970, a young couple. He was in the military, and he and his young lady friend were sitting not too far from Bunny Man Bridge in one of the little neighborhoods in their car, and they were talking. They actually would end up getting married, and they saw a man in a white bunny suit come out of the darkness, and he came up to them, and the young man rolled his car window down and said, "Is everything okay?" And the guy started yelling, the bunny man started yelling, and he was screaming, "You know, I don't understand why all you people think you have a right to trespass." And he's yelling, and he's got a hatchet in his hand. And as he's screaming, he gets more and more upset, and he slams the hatchet into the windshield and shatters it. At this point, the young man realizes that this guy's unhinged. He starts the car up and he takes off, you know, down the road away from this. It's the 1970s, so they have to knock on doors until they find someone that's willing to let them use a phone. Mm-hmm. They use the phone. They call the police. The police come out, and they think it's a prank at first because it's October. So they're like, okay, it's just some sick joke. But about 2 weeks later, there's not so far away, about a half a mile away, there is a security guard. There's this housing complex, and none of the houses have been moved into yet. And he's guarding the complex like he's supposed to. And one night he sees motion on the cameras. So his job's to go out and, you know, make sure that what's going on, that there's no break-ins or, you know, somebody vandalizing, things like that.
Right.
And as he gets to this one house, he sees that on the porch, there is a man standing in a white rabbit costume with the big long ears, the whole nine yards, and he's holding a hatchet. So the guy goes up and he says, you know, what are you doing here? You're on private property. And he's like, you're on private property. This is, you know, I don't understand why you people think you have a right to just go on anybody's property you want to. And he gets really angry. And as he's talking, he starts swinging this hatchet. And he's swinging it and catching one of the posts on the porch. And just almost punctuating his sentences with a thwack of that hatchet on the porch. And it freaks out the security guard, rightfully so. Mm-hmm. And the guard's like, okay, dude, I'm leaving. I'm gone. And as he's backing away from this guy, the guy screams, I'm going to bust you in the head. If you don't get out of here, I mean it. So the guy just, you know, he takes off and he calls the cops. The cops come out. They find where the hatchet marks are. The security guard is really rattled. But, and they started asking around, you know, has anybody else seen anything? There are a couple people who claim that they saw a man in a rabbit costume. And again, it's October. So although it's weird, until the story breaks in the newspapers, which it does eventually, mm-hmm. everybody's assuming you're going to a party or something. So, you know, they don't really ascribe the severity to what we might have in January or July. And they never catch the guy, but he is seen multiple other times. And they have no clue to this day who it is. And whoever it was, it's over like a 40-year span that this story continues where he's sighted. And then years will go by, nothing. And then he's sighted. And the interesting thing is originally the first time it's thought that he was an older person. And in the later sightings, it's a younger person. And there is a theory that there was a guy who had owned that that whole area and it had been taken from him. I don't know if it was sheriff's sale or how it worked or what happened, but he lost the property. And he was very angry about that. And he was angry about people trespassing. He'd always been one of those crazy old men who would chase you for trespassing. But the idea of why he would put on a bunny suit, nobody has an answer for that. And if it's an older man at the beginning and a younger man at the end, the only other option that the police have come up with is it may be his nephew, who he was very close to, eventually took up the storyline, which means yeah. we have two very mentally unhinged men.
Yeah. And the thing that went through my head is, okay, so if it was a transient or somebody like, you know, living in a tent or someplace else like that, you'd think that this white bunny suit would cease to be white after a certain period of time. So if he kept being seen, that I'm thinking like, okay, it got dirty, it got laundered, you know. So if it didn't go to the local dry cleaners, who could probably, you know, say who it was. And I don't know if there's a confidentiality agreement with people who do dry cleaning, but yeah, you know, that indicates, you know, a fixed address, and you know, so somebody who would look to be normal.
I have to tell you, the early 1970s were bizarre because there were tons of sightings of rabbit men all over the country, bat men. At the same time, that's whenever the whole thing about crazy people in white vans kidnapping your children started up. And in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, there's a cemetery, huge cemetery, and this would be the same time frame. There was a series of police calls in one afternoon about a man, a 6 foot tall man in a bunny costume, hopping around the cemetery. It's a big cemetery, and everybody knows there's lots of famous people buried there. And so the police come out, and when they get there, they see them. They actually see the guy in a bunny suit, mm-hmm. and he runs out a side gate, and as he sees them, and down the street to a bar, they chase him and they follow him into the bar. I'm not lying. This is a true story. I've read the newspaper accounts, mm-hmm. and they get into the bar. Of course, the bar is you know, darker and smoky, the way bars looked in the 70s.
Right.
And they don't see him at all, but they followed him. They were maybe five steps behind him. They're sure he went in this bar. So immediately one of them breaks away and heads for the bathroom. The other one says to the bartender, did anybody go through there to the kitchen? And they split up. He's not there. They ask their patrons. The patrons say they didn't see him. I think there was one patron who said, I think he went to the bathroom, man. And everybody else just said they didn't see anything. But this went on for weeks. There's another story in the same area of a man in a rabbit suit who the kids in town became frightened of. And they actually created gangs of teenage boys and like 12, 13-year-old boys. And they would patrol the parks while the other kids were playing, because they were afraid that the Batman or the Rabbit Man, they had two different ones they saw, would come and hurt one of them. So this was a bizarre period of time. And as crazy as it sounds that there's a dude running around with a rabbit costume on, it was happening all across the country.
Wonder if something got put in the water in the 70s. Because
the LSD was pretty popular back then, too. Well,
wasn't that the time frame, too, in the 70s? I can't pinpoint exactly when it was. The poisoning in the Tylenol, and then that caused all the...
Oh, I know what you're talking about. That, yeah, that would have been the 70s, I think.
And that caused all the safety sealing then on all the over-the-counter medications. And, yeah, that happened in the 70s, I think late 70s.
Yeah. I think it was pretty much at the end of the 70s. Yeah, the people that are young have no clue. Like, you used to be able to buy everything, and there was nothing. There was no safety sealing on it. They didn't have plastic wrap around the cap.
Just cotton. Yeah.
Yeah. And then this lady decided to murder somebody, and then she put the rest of the poison in Tylenol bottles and put them back on the shelf to try to misdirect the police. But she did get caught. Eventually, she did get caught. So the next story is, it's kind of a trope on an old urban legend. So in Hollywood area, there were always these stories, these urban legends, that real corpses were used in movies, and that they were used instead of dummies. Now, there's been two stories, and one of them was in Southern California. So there was a notorious outlaw by the name of Elmer McCurdy, and he died in the early 1900s, it was 1911. In 1911, his body was embalmed, and nobody came to collect the body. So the undertaker sold it, and it became part of a traveling show. So you could see the body of this infamous outlaw, and he traveled all over Texas with this traveling show. And it would be, you know, displayed in like a funeral parlor thing, and it was in carnivals, and it got sold repeatedly and passed along. Fast forward till modern times, early 1970s. In Long Beach, California, somebody bought the body thinking that it was a macabre prop to use in a movie. And they hung him in a fun house in a place called the New Pike Amusement Park. And it was there that they were shooting an episode of the $6 Million Man.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You remember.
Never missed one. Yep.
Yep. It was a great TV show in mid-1970s. This is 1976. They were filming an episode, and they were trying to adjust the mannequin. And as the person who was adjusting the mannequin was pulling and tugging on the mannequin to try to get it to be twisted so that they could see the macabre face and all this, right? And he pulled an arm off. And it was only then that he realized this wasn't a mannequin. Nobody understood it wasn't a mannequin. And everything stopped. They had to figure out what to do. Took a while, but eventually the decision was that he would be put to rest, and so he was eventually buried. But the thought that for all these years he was traveling around, and it fits the urban legend that some of the mannequins that are used in movies and TV and in places like Disneyland and stuff are not. There's a story, a legend, that there was a mannequin, I think it was on the Pirates of the Caribbean, that turned out to be a skeletal remains, where skeletons hung in the Pirate of the Caribbean's thing. And it turned out that one of them had actually been a real human skeleton. It had been bought by a doctor at the early turn of the 20th century. And for those who don't realize it, they actually did buy real skeletons of dead people in the 1800s and then early 1900s to use for hanging up in the doctor's office or for teaching colleges and stuff like this. And that's what he had been. He had had his, they had boiled his bones and then reassembled him as a skeleton. And it turned out he was one of the skeletons on the Pirates of the Caribbean exhibit. And somebody eventually realized it was a real skeleton and removed it. I'm telling you, some of this stuff is just insane.
Yeah, truth is stranger than fiction sometimes.
Yeah, as I was going through these, and what started it is the story I'm going to tell you next. But I was going through them, and I'm starting to go, I wonder if there's any truth to this one. And I knew this particular story that's coming up next had some truth to it. And so I started poking around a little bit and realized that probably about 40% of the legends I was looking at have a real backstory. So the next one that I'm going to tell is actually one that's not too far from my home. This is out near Pittsburgh. And the title for the little piece I read was Ghost Says No to Walmart. That's all it said. But because I happened to have been traveling Pittsburgh area quite frequently at the time this all happened, I wrote at the bottom, this has to be the Walmart that never got built near Pittsburgh. And as I poked around a little more, I came up with the fact that it really was that. So the storyline for the urban legend is that there was this mental health hospital, and it was, you know, a place where people were treated horrendously, and Walmart bought this piece of ground and tore down the mental hospital, and all the tortured souls are still there from the that died at this mental hospital, and they didn't want a Walmart built on the property, desecrating their where their bodies were, and you know, and blah blah blah. So they haunted the site. I know this story. Okay. Oh boy, do I know this story. So there's a place called Killbuck, which is right outside of Pittsburgh, and it was this huge property. And there was the site of the Dixmont Mental Facility, mental health facility. It was a state hospital. Now, all that crap about it, the people being tortured and yada, 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 that is just window dressing. It was called Dixmont because it was named for a woman by the name of Dorothea Dix. Dorothea Dix was a nurse, and she had actually served during the Civil War. And Dorothea Dix built this facility to prove her theories on how you help a person with mental health issues. So far from Dorothea Dix being this horrible witch who tortured people, she really rerouted mental health. Up to that point, you were stuck in a mental health facility and rotted. That's pretty much all that happened. Dorothea Dix was like, no, this is wrong. This is, you need to, you know, educate these people. You need to utilize their strengths. So she built Dixmont, and she built it as a farm, and people that lived there, they would help in the farm, and they would help in the dairy, and they would help in the kitchens, and they were productive, and she assisted them with learning skill sets. And it was everything I've ever read about Dorothea Dix, she was a very kind and loving woman who believed that you treated the mentally handicapped with great respect and dignity, that you opened doors for them and gave them hope rather than just warehousing them. So that line about all that is not true. But in about 2006, a gentleman bought this huge property where Dixmont sat, and it had been closed for years and abandoned. And he sold a piece of this property to the Walmart company. They were going to put this great big Walmart out there. And that's when things got interesting. So the building had been empty for about 15 years, and they were going to tear him down. As they started to tear down the buildings, and there was a cemetery there for those people who died that didn't have family that would, you know, help them be interred. Right. Dorothea Dix had a cemetery placed there so that everybody could be buried with dignity and respect. And that would have to be moved. And that's when the equipment began to malfunction. So there were huge amounts of equipment malfunctioning. There were backhoes and different pieces of large equipment that would just go down daily. They would have them shipped out to be fixed, and they would be told they were fine. They would be brought back to the site. They would get in them, and 3 minutes later, they would quit again. They started to suspect that it was human interference. There were people who felt very strongly that they didn't need a Walmart. They would rather have the relic of Dixmont. So obviously security had to be purchased because the equipment, you know, obviously was being damaged in some way, although they couldn't find out how. That was the interesting part. Like, it wasn't like somebody put gas in the or sugar in the gas tank or pulled wires. It just quit working. And then came along something that was really interesting. And this is the part I remember the most, because I had to travel along the road where this whole event was going on. Okay. And this had been going on for years. Like, it took 7 years and they still couldn't get everything together to put the Walmart in. Think about that. They spent hundreds of thousands, like $500,000. And at one point, and then they spent another $900,000, but they still couldn't get anything going. As soon as something would get, you know, torn down, everything would break down. As soon as they start to dig for something, everything would break down. And then the largest landslide in Pennsylvania history took place, and it literally dumped thousands and thousands and thousands of square feet of dirt onto the highway, and it shut down a major highway. It literally slid off the hillside straight down. And it was interesting because it was, you know, it was Pennsylvania. So a little bit of rain, but it wasn't like torrential rain for 2 weeks or something like that. Eventually, there were stories about the security guards seeing people walking in what looked like hospital gowns, and they would see them on the cameras, and they would go out and there would be nobody there. Lights shooting around at night, and they would think, okay, somebody's got flashlights. They would go out, there'd be nothing there. Nobody was ever caught or recorded on camera. And there were stories about video cameras catching a person walking, you know, along a path or a trail that had been cut by some of the heavy equipment and then just disappearing in the middle of the path. Those kinds of things. After all the expense and after the largest landslide in Pennsylvania history, Walmart gave up on the project. So there is no Walmart there. And the reason why is because it became exceedingly expensive and difficult. And after 7 years of attempting to put the Walmart in, everybody just said uncle.
Wow. Now, I've lived in Pennsylvania a long time, and I've never heard that story before.
When it was going on, like, I was headed out to Pittsburgh. A lot of friends out that way, and I was doing a lot of speaking gigs in that area at the time. And I actually drove through the area where the landslide was, and it was like at 5 or 6 lanes of highway. And, like, they had one lane open at that point. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. So I get to my speaking gig and I said, man, I had a hard time going up this road. And it looks like some sort of a great big landslide or something happened. I have no clue what's going on. And that's whenever somebody that lived in the area said, oh, haven't you heard this story? Mm. And so after that, I began to pay closer attention, and I watched it playing out over the course of several years.
And I thought those people would be very persistent about, like, no, we want a Walmart here. But I mean, that's almost like the hand of God saying, like, no, you won't.
Yeah, I mean, literally, they were looking at the local economy was looking at about $1 million income coming in, you know, per year from the Walmart. There were a lot of people excited about it. And there were a few people, like I said, who were like purists, and they were like, just no, you shouldn't tear down Dorothea Dix's monument to mental health. But it was empty and outdated, and it was never going to get used again. And the area and the developers saw an opportunity and took it, or attempted to take it, but something, God, ghosts, or the curse of Dorothea Dix, whatever it was, but they never did get to put the Walmart in.
Another thing for me to look up when we're done tonight.
You have a little list, don't you?
I do. I mean, I'm fascinated. I even mentioned in the last episode that we did, you know, I'm always thirsty for more knowledge. So, yeah, it's a, you know, I will turn 60 next month. I have no hesitancy to hide that. I mean, but I feel young. But anyway, it's a good day if I learn something new every day. So it's.
See, that's how my life has been, because, you know, I treasure hunt. I call them treasure hunts. My version of a treasure hunt is finding great stories and sharing them with other people. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful that people will listen. I find the most bizarre stuff, and one little thing will take me to the next thing. And the next thing, you know, I'm down a rabbit hole, and then I'm down three more rabbit holes. And I've got four episodes started for the podcast. So folks, keep listening, tell your friends, tell your family. I got a heck of a lot more stories to tell. But there's a couple more for this episode, and then we're done. Okay. So one of my favorite places I've ever traveled to in my entire life was Salem, Massachusetts. Have you ever been there?
I have not. I've been close, but have not actually been there. Mrs. Stu has. You know, she's been to the Salem Witches Museum, and, you know, we have refrigerator magnet and the thimble. And anytime we travel someplace, that's what we get. We get the refrigerator magnet and the thimble.
Yeah. Oh, okay. You have a collection. So I actually got to go with my best friend years ago, and we had a blast. I learned that there were two Salems. There's Salem and Salem Town. I learned that Gallows Hill was not in Salem, but in Salem Town, you know, a couple miles away, went to Gallows Hill. I learned that 19 people had been executed there, and one man, Giles Corey, had been pressed to death in Salem, in a field by the courthouse or the sheriff's office. And I also learned that the only people to get executed were those who would not confess to being a witch. So there were about 200 people accused throughout the process. And if you said, yeah, I was a witch, and I rebuke it all, and here's my money, and here's my home, and here's everything I've ever earned in my entire life, and you gave it all to the sheriff, you were good to go. You could get out of there with your life, at least. The 19 women and the one man who did not confess to being witches were the ones who were executed. And this brings us to a gentleman by the name of Sheriff George Corwin, who was known as the Strangler by people in the village. He was judge, jury, and executioner in a great lot of ways. Now, there was a judge who actually presided over it. But the way this thing worked, if you were found guilty, then the powers that be, the judge and the sheriff, could take your property. You ended up forfeiting everything you had, and then they could sell it or you make it their own. So the Salem witch trials were not about witchcraft at all. They were about graft and greed. That's all they were about at the end of the day. And the only reason the witch trials stopped is because more and more wealthy people began to get accused. Like when they were accusing just guys that owned, people that owned a little cottage or a small piece of, you know, land, then nobody said boo to them. It was okay, you know, it just happened. But whenever the governor's wife got accused, that's when the governor stepped in and said, enough of this foolishness. Mm-hmm. Now, back to our sheriff, our intrepid sheriff. The house he lived in is now called the Joshua Ward House. I've been there. And when all this was going on, there was a farmer by the name of Giles Corey. I have to tell you that, or Giles Corey, I have to tell you that Giles turned his own wife in so that he wouldn't get accused of witchcraft. And for his, betrayal, be a good word. Eventually, the townspeople who applauded him for turning his wife in came for him as well, because if she were a witch, he would be a warlock. So he, you see, mm-hmm. he wasn't thinking this puppy through. Mm-hmm. So, and he would have got to keep his property if they had taken her, because he owned it, not her. So he thought he had this whole thing figured out, but he didn't. So he's being told he has to confess by the sheriff, and he refuses. So they do something called pressing. They put a board down on his chest. They pin him on the ground. They put a board on his chest, and then they begin to lift heavy rocks as big as a man can lift and drop them on his chest. And every time a new rock was added, the sheriff would say, "Will you confess now?" And Giles Corey would say, "More weight." And this continued for hours and hours and hours. He couldn't breathe. And the last thing he gasped out was, "More weight." And then he said, "I curse you, George Corwin and Salem," and died. Now, when Corwin died, he was 38 years old. He died of a sudden heart attack. And the following sheriff died at approximately mid-30s of a bizarre blood disease that affected his heart. And the next one of the same bizarre blood disease that affected his heart also died in his mid-30s. Corwin was so hated that his family, when he died, couldn't bury him in the local cemetery. They had to bury him in the basement of the house because they were afraid townspeople would dig him up and desecrate the body.
Wow.
And Corey's curse continued on until just about 10 years ago is the first sheriff that's held that job in Salem that did not die in his mid-30s of a blood disease or a heart attack.
You would think, yeah, that's normally an elected position, right? Mm-hmm. You would think that people would say, "I'm not running."
And I agree. I mean, like, I think that there was, you know, at the beginning that was like, "Oh, it's a coincidence." And then I think what happened later is that people from out of town or people that were more progressive, they were like, "Oh, I don't believe that bullshit," kind of a deal. But until it was about 10, 12 years ago, when I remember reading an article about the fact that possibly Giles Corey's curse had finally been lifted, because this particular gentleman who took the job of sheriff had made it like to his 40s and he hadn't died of a heart attack or a blood disease. And that was exactly what it was every time. So the urban legend about curses and being cursed, well, Giles Corey very well might have actually managed to curse the sheriffs of Salem Town.
You think that they would have solved all that by just saying, like, nope, Corey was not a warlock. You know, we declare him, you know, innocent, and he was unjustly, you know, murdered, essentially. Yeah. So.
Yeah, there's a lot of fascinating history that wraps around all of that. And when you start pulling it all apart, you start to see that it was really all about, like, you had to, in this jail, you had to pay for the space you stood in. So there were, I remember I went there as well. And I remember there were these places where they had chiseled out the rock on both sides and you could like wedge something in there. And I said, "What on earth would you do that for?" And they said, "Because if you couldn't afford to pay, you had to stand in there all the time. And obviously you would have to sleep at some point. So they wedged you in there. So you had to sleep standing because you cost them money." But and there's a lot of more fascinating stories about all of this. Pennsylvania, I don't know if you know this or not, but there were two witch trials in Pennsylvania, although William Penn handled it completely differently. And in, I believe it was Mercersburg, there were two dogs that were tried and hung for being witch familiars.
Dogs, huh?
My brain is full of absolutely useless knowledge. I apologize to everybody from the depths of my heart, but I read this stuff and it never goes away. I actually read the documents for the trial for the dogs. I spent one very happy afternoon in Mercersburg Library doing that.
Bye.
I was talking to them looking for something else, and the lady said, "Oh, you like unusual things. You're the," and I said, "Yeah." And she's like, "You're not the lady." And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm the ghost lady." So she goes, "Wait, we have this archive of stuff you're going to love." And I'm so grateful that all these people are willing to do that for me. So she starts hauling this stuff out, and she's like, "You've got to read about the dogs that were hung for witch familiars." And she starts dragging it out, and I spent the whole afternoon and early into the evening reading all this stuff.
Goodness.
Yep, that's my life, man. And I love it. I wouldn't trade it for $1 million. Now I have one last legend.
All right.
That we're going to talk about, and then I'm done for today. So everybody's familiar with that, the movies, the slasher flicks, where, you know, teenage girls babysitting the kids, and all of a sudden, you know, there's that phone call, and then it's somebody threatening her, and then you realize it's, you know, somebody on the other end of the line, and they're like, "I know what you did last summer." And then you start tracing the call, and you call the police, and the police call you back, and they're like, "Get out of the house! Get out of the house, man! They're calling from inside the house!" We've all seen those slasher flicks, right?
Right.
And guess what? There is one that actually spawned a real story that actually spawned all those slasher flicks.
Wow.
True story. Tragically true story. So let's take a little deep dive into this story. This legend is actually happened because of an unsolved murder case from 1950. So the story is that there was this little girl. She was an eighth grader, and she had been asked to a party, and she decided to take the high road and go work that night and babysit for a local a neighbor. And so her name was Jane, this little girl, and she was going to babysit. The little boy she was babysitting was already in bed when she gets there. And excuse me, Janet, not Jane, but Janet. Janet Christman was her name. And she was babysitting for the family named Romack. They had a little boy's three, sound asleep. She gets there. She's like hanging out, just diddle bopping, being a kid, you know. And then suddenly, nobody knows to this day exactly how this all happened. They suspect that he was hiding upstairs. She makes this terrified phone call, and she just keeps screaming into the phone, "Come quick, come quick," and she's hysterical. She can't tell them where she's at. She's not telling them anything that they can use, but she's called the police. And nobody can figure out. They can hear her screaming. She drops the phone. Horrible screams, traumatizing to just listen to. They're literally listening to this young girl die, the policeman. And they can't do anything. So about 1 o'clock in the morning, the Romacks come back home. They get into the house, and immediately they know there's been trouble. There's living room. The house is torn to pieces. They find Janet's body laying in the living room. She's been strangled by an electrical cord from the iron, and she was raped. Her killer was never found. There were suspects. There was a gentleman by the name of Mueller. He was 27. He knew the Romacks. He was a friend of theirs and had on a couple occasions commented on how well-developed Janet was. And it made, when this all happened, Mr. Romack flashed back to that and began to wonder if this guy might have done it. Whoever the person was, the police believe that he was upstairs, that she might have known him, and when he came down the stairs, she didn't panic until he got really close, and that's whenever she started fighting for her life. And that is the story behind all those slasher flicks. So urban legends quite often hide truth. That's the story.
Mm-hmm.
Poor Janet was only a 13-year-old little girl, and I don't know how the story made it from being the tragic piece of history that it is to somebody deciding that it was a trope that they could use for all these different slasher flicks. But I Know What You Did Last Summer. There's dozens of them. Yeah.
Scream movies. Yeah.
And they're all based loosely on this scenario.
That actually happened.
Yeah. It actually happened. And with that, I am done for tonight. If you guys like them and they want to hear more urban legends that are turning out to be true, I would be happy. I literally have 500 pages of them. I'm warning you all, be careful what you ask for. When I do a deep dive, I do a deep dive. I went to lift a file from my one laptop to the other, and I realized I had to do it in pieces because the little one, it had 578 pages, and I'm like, I'm just going to do this, pick the ones I like and just carry them over for right now. So there is a ton of stories. And I have always said when I research for a book that I look for the local folklore, and then I look to see what part of it is true, because there's usually always a kernel of truth in everything. Not always, but almost always. And I have found amazing stories, a lost Confederate soldier, so many things through following that methodology. And so when I started approaching these urban legends, I did exactly the same thing. So what part of this is true, if any of it? And I began to do research, and it was literally a matter of moments till I pinned the first one down. And I'm like, okay, I got something here.
I'm happy you did.
It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to share the stories and look them up and see all the backstories.
Well, I got nothing else to say.
Nope. So guys, if you enjoyed it, let us know. Check out Cropsy, the documentary. It's a really cool documentary. And send in your ideas. I have not forgotten. I have a gentleman who asked me one about witchcraft in modern society. Working on that one. That's a lot more complicated than it sounds. I have another gentleman who has mentioned to me he would like some Civil War stories that do not come from Gettysburg. Got that on the making. Fortunately, I have the ear of a gentleman by the name of Mark Nesbitt, who just wrote a book a couple years ago about Civil War battlefields that are haunted, a dear friend of mine. So I have lots of stuff that he sent me out to find that I'm going to, you know, work with to put this piece together, and other stories as well. So please, please send us your information, share stories with us. We will be sharing them. I have a couple stories from a one lady I'd like to get shared in the next few weeks. And I hope everybody enjoyed themselves. Thank you for listening. We appreciate it.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.